We're continuing our study in the 10th Psalm, and in this 10th Psalm we find that David is discussing the fact that he's in a situation of distress, distress that is caused by his enemies, enemies that are also the enemies of God, for the enemies of David were the enemies of God at this time. And so he spends a large part of this psalm describing the character of the enemy. He does this down through the 11th verse, and in the 11th verse he says, talking about the enemy, talking about those that are opposed to God, he has said in his heart, God hath forgotten. He hideth his face. He will never see it. This is one of the ways that the wicked people could do the things that they do and not feel too badly about them, is that they say that God has forgotten. God will not see what I do. God will never see it. So if he never sees it, then I'll never be punished. I'll never have to face this in the judgment, and so I can do it and get away with it. Now that's just what is said in his heart. This is the innermost feeling of this person, or these persons who continually do wicked things. They tell themselves that God is not going to ever bring about any consequences for it. But beginning in the 12th verse, which is where our lesson begins today, the writer of this psalm turns from giving just a description of the character of the wicked, and he begins to ask God to deliver him. He appeals to God to give him help in this situation. So verse 12 says, Arise, O Lord. O God, lift up thine hand, forget not the humble. And he is saying this as though God has been neglecting him, as though God has been reclining and not paying any attention to his problem, to his state of distress. And this is really not the case. It just simply means that God does allow his people to be punished. He does allow his people to have this affliction come upon them. He does allow the wicked to afflict the just many times, and while he's allowing this to happen, it seems as though God is neglecting them. It seems as though God's not paying them any attention. And although this is not true, it seems like it is, and it seems to go against the very nature of God that he would allow these things to happen. So the psalmist calls upon God to arise. Arise, O Lord. And he says, O God, lift up thine hand. The hand is the part of the body that's going to bring about some kind of action or activity. The hand is what the body uses to either defend itself or to do some kind of work or to go on the offensive against an enemy. And so he's using that in a figurative term here to God, as though God has a hand that he needs to lift up and put into action for his protection, for the protection of David. And he says, lift up thine hand and forget not the humble. The word here for humble, that is rendered humble, really means the afflicted. Not just the humble, but here's a person who's afflicted. Here's a person who's in some kind of distress, and he's asking God to take notice. See what's happening to me. Do not forget me. Take some kind of heed to my predicament, and then go into action, do something about it. Now in verse 13, he asks a very good question. He says, Wherefore doth the wicked contemn God? Now this word for contemn means to regard God with contempt, to look upon God in a way in which he despises God. He regards God as being worthless. He takes away his honor, his glory, his power. That's the way the wicked considers God. That's the way the wicked treats God. That's the way the wicked acts, as though God is, as though God is a despised being, as though God is a being that does not really exist or does not really have any power. And so it's a good question, is why does the wicked do this? Wherefore doth the wicked contemn God? How can the wicked allow himself to get into the position of thinking of God in such a low, mean way? How can the wicked become so distorted in his thinking that he ceases to believe that God really is, or that God really has the power to do the things that he does? And he then answers that question in the same verse. He has said in his heart, Thou wilt not require it. That is, the wicked has convinced himself. He has said in his heart, he said in his deepermost areas of where his thinking process is, that thou wilt not require it. Now it seems that the wicked does a lot of this saying in his heart. He repeats this three times in this psalm. In the sixth verse, he says, talking about the wicked, he has said in his heart, I shall not be moved, for I shall never be in adversity. So there he's convinced himself that he's never going to have to suffer any problems because of his wicked behavior. Then again in the 11th verse, he has said in his heart, God hath forgotten, he hideth his face, he will never see it. There he's convinced himself that God is not going to see what his actions are and that God's going to forget about his wrongdoings. And now he says in the 13th verse, he has said in his heart, "Thou will not require it." That is, God will not require any kind of an accounting. God will not require him to stand before the judgment day. God will not require him to give answer for his bad deeds. And so once a person can convince himself of this, that God is not going to require it, that God's not going to move me, God's not going to put me in kind of adversity, God's not going to see what I've done, God's going to forget what I've done, he will never see it, then it's not too hard to do what the wicked do. And that's what happens here then. The wicked deceive themselves. The wicked allow themselves to be victims of a false belief. They believe that God has a nature that's different from what his true nature is. They believe that God is not going to require any kind of an accounting, any kind of a judgment, any kind of a reckoning for the evil deeds that he does. He says, "Thou wilt not require it." So now we see that we have fairly well established that the wicked do what they do because they have deceived themselves into a false belief about God. And he asks and answers that question in the 13th verse. "Wherefore doth the wicked contemn God? He has said in his heart, Thou wilt not require it." Verse 14, "Thou hast seen it, for thou beholdest mischief and spite to requite it with thy hand." Now he shows that there is a difference, though, in what the wicked believe and what God really does. God does not turn his head and not see these wicked deeds. God does not forget these evil doings of those that are opposed to him. But verse 14 says, "Thou hast seen it." God has seen these things. God did not allow himself to be blinded to what was happening. "For thou beholdest mischief and spite." The word here for mischief would indicate the trouble that had been brought upon David. The evil deeds that had come his way. The things that had been done to him that were improper to be done. "Thou beholdest mischief and spite." And this word spite can have several meanings, but it probably means some kind of malice, maybe mild malice, or revenge. And so those are the actions that have been done against David. He'd had things done to him to cause him to be in trouble, to have trouble, to trouble him either physically or mentally or both. And it had things to happen that were acts of malice, acts to do him some true damage or acts of revenge. So thou beholdest mischief and spite. And, you know, two of the most basic actions that humans can have today are these two things of mischief and spite. We are continually doing things to where we try to get back at somebody else. We want to spite them. We want to get some revenge. We want to do some kind of a little act maybe that's got some malice in it. It's going to bring about a little bit of harm to the person, maybe harm their character or maybe harm their image in the light of other men. We may just say some bad remarks about them, but nevertheless, there's spite behind it. Well, God sees all this. Thou beholdest mischief and spite. And he further says, to requite it with thy hand. The word requite means to punish. You look upon these things so that you can punish it with your hand. You're going to bring about a reckoning. You are going to punish all these misdeeds. Man will have to give an answer to every deed that's done in his body. And so God sees all these things. And he sees it with an eye to whether or not he's going to need to punish this. Yeah, he sees it to requite it with thy hand. And he further says in this 14th verse, the poor committeth himself unto thee. Thou art the helper of the fatherless. So the poor committeth himself. That is, the poor has given his self over to you. He has placed his safety. He's placed his future in your hands. You know, when you commit yourself, that means that you then have completely turned loose of all other means of support. You have let go of all other avenues of escape or help, and you have now placed all of your destiny in the hands of this one thing. And that's what happens whenever we commit ourselves to God. We place our destiny, not only our physical, bodily destiny, our life on this earth, but we also place our soul's destiny in the hands of the great God. So the poor committeth himself unto thee. That is, the poor are placing their complete dependence upon God. They have no other source that they're going to depend upon. They then truly trust in the great God. And he further rounds that thought out by saying, thou art the helper of the fatherless. You're the one that the poor look to. They don't have any other father. They don't have any other helper. You are the one then that they're going to depend upon. And so they have committed themselves to you. They put their trust in you. And this is a contrast now between the wicked and the just. The wicked say that God forgets, that God doesn't see, that God doesn't require it. The wicked says that I shall never have any problem. I'll never be in any adversity. But the poor, they commit themselves to God. They depend upon God. They know that God does see and that God does act and that God does not forget. Thou art the helper of the fatherless. And this phrase is just kind of a general summation then of the character of God when it comes to assisting those that are in times of need who are righteous people. Thou art the helper of the fatherless. So in verse 15 he implores God, break thou the arm of the wicked and the evil man. To break the arm is to render someone helpless, to cause them to stop doing their actions, whatever those may be. To break the arm is to take some positive action towards stopping these actions. So he says, break the arm of the wicked and the evil man. That is all evil persons, all those that would do things that are contrary to thy will. Put an end to that. Do something to stop them. And the last part of the verse 15 says, seek out his wickedness till thou find none. Now, till thou find none means till it is all punished. Find all the wickedness that can be found and punish it until there is no more left. Now, if it's right to punish one single act of wickedness, then it's also right to punish every act of wickedness. And that's what's going to happen. God's not going to just punish a few acts of wickedness. He's going to punish all of them. There will not be any act of wickedness that will not go unpunished. And so, seek out his wickedness till thou find none. Find every last act of wickedness until there's no more to be found. And then these are the things that you're going to punish. It would be most improper to punish just a few acts of wickedness and then let other acts of wickedness go unpunished. That's not in accordance with justice. That's not in accordance with the ways of God. So we can see here then that the idea is that every act of wickedness is going to be punished. And so if we're guilty of just a few, if we're guilty of just one, or if we're guilty of many, we still have to realize that every one of these acts of wickedness, everything that is considered to be wickedness, is going to be sought out by God. It's going to be dealt with on an individual basis, and this will be done until he finds none. That is, until it is all punished, till there's no more wickedness left to be punished. And so that's a very sobering thought then when we see what this prayer really is asking God to do. And since this prayer is given by miraculous divine inspiration, we know that these are the things that God wants his people to ask for. This was an appropriate thing for the writer of this psalm to ask for, because it's in accordance with the will and the actions, with the doings of the great God. So it makes us stop and think that no act of wickedness then is going to go unpunished, is going to get away without being noticed by the one who is going to be the judge of all the earth. Verse 16, the Lord is King forever and ever. Now, just as this psalm begins with a disparaging note, as though the wicked is going to be successful. He says, the wicked in his pride doth persecute the poor. It seems that the wicked are having the predominance in the affairs of this life. He ends the psalm on a victorious note for God and the people of God. The Lord is King forever and ever. So regardless of what transpires in this life, regardless of how much success the wicked seem to have, regardless of how much oppression the people of God seem to have, still the Lord is King forever and ever. Nothing's going to change that. He will always be the King. He will always reign supreme. He will always be in charge, in command. So that is a very comforting thought. The Lord is King forever and ever. He is going to be successful. He is going to dominate. And this is going to happen over a never-ending period of time. And he concludes that verse by saying, the heathen are perished out of his land. Now, the heathen are the enemies of God. And they're depicted here as though they are foreigners. They're strangers. And so there are people who do not belong in this land. They've got no business here in the first place. And the ultimate goal then is going to be that they're going to be perished out of his land. The word here for land would really mean the Holy Land. It would apply to the time of Palestine in the Old Testament in times in which this psalm was written. But now it would be applicable to the church. Whatever the territory of the kingdom of God happens to be, that's where the heathen are not welcomed. That is, the enemies are not welcomed. They're eventually going to be made to perish out of this region. They're not going to be allowed to stand or to live here where the righteous people are. And he speaks of this as though it has already happened. It hasn't happened at the time this is being written, or he wouldn't have an occasion to speak against the oppression that's caused by these enemies, by these heathen. But he speaks of it as though it has already happened because it is such a sure thing that it's going to happen. We see something similar to this in Romans chapter 4, verse 17, where he's talking about Abraham. There he says, "As it is written, I have made thee a father of many nations, before him whom he believed, even God, who quickeneth the dead, and calleth those things which be not as though they were." So that's what is happening in this psalm. The heathen are perished out of his land, is calling those things which are not as though they were. He's talking about it as though it had already happened, even though it was something that was yet to happen in the future. So ultimately then, God is going to rid his kingdom, his land, of the heathen, that is, of the enemies of God. They're going to be forced to perish out of the land because God is going to remain the king and not be dominated by the power of any. And of course, this is a very comforting thought to those who are the children of God, to those who are being oppressed by the wicked, to those who have committed themselves to God for their care and their protection, to know then that God ultimately will come to their rescue, that God will not allow the wicked of the world to dominate over his people. In verse 17, he begins to bring this psalm to an end. He begins his concluding remarks, which are very comforting to us, and verses 17 and 18 are all one sentence. He says in verse 17, "Lord, thou hast heard the desire of the humble. Thou wilt prepare their heart. Thou wilt cause thine ear to hear." Now, to hear the desire of the humble simply means that he has heard the prayer of the humble. We are expected to bring our desires, our needs, our wants, our thoughts to God. Bring them to him in the form of a prayer. Thou hast heard the desire of the humble. And so once we bring them to God, then God can be said to have heard them. Now, until we bring them to God, though, we cannot confidently say that he's heard our desire, our prayer. It must be first brought to God. This not only assures that we have put it in the form of a prayer, that we have stated our desire, but it also assures that we have taken enough time to approach God with the matter. And then for God to have heard it then is a very comforting thing for us. He's heard the desire of the humble. He says in the next phrase, "Thou wilt prepare their heart." Now, to prepare the heart really means to establish the heart. God's going to give us comfort. He's going to give us a sense of having been heard, a sense of having had some attention paid to our needs and to our problems. And so this then will begin to alleviate our anxiety. This will begin to give us some relief from our time of distress. The very fact that he then has prepared the heart, that he has established the heart, that he's given assurance to us that the problem is going to work out all right. And so that is certainly an important thing with us, just to have some relief from our anxiety, even before the prayer is answered, even before we get the good news that things have been changed to a favorable state for us. We begin to have relief from our distress because God will prepare their heart. God begins to work on our mind, begins to work on our feelings about this thing after we pray to him. And then he says in the last phrase of verse 17, "Thou wilt cause thine ear to hear." God's going to hear. God's going to put himself into a position where he will be able and willing to hear what our petition is. But this phrase, "Thou wilt cause thine ear to hear," has a continuation in the next verse, verse 18. "Thou wilt cause thine ear to hear to judge the fatherless and the oppressed." That's just what God's going to do. He's going to pass judgment upon the fatherless and the oppressed, which means that he will take notice of them. He's going to notice their situation. He's going to determine that they are righteous, that they are in need of help, that they are justified in being helped by him, that they are the righteous party of these two conflicting groups. And so his judgment then will be in their favor. And the fatherless or are those that not only are orphans, but it's represented by those that are in a helpless or non-self-sufficient state. God is the God of those. He takes their part. He takes the part of those that are the underdog, as we would term it, the fathers and the oppressed. The oppressed are those who are receiving some kind of maltreatment by their fellows. And the result of this is going to be, in the last phrase, that the man of the earth may no more oppress. Now, the man of the earth is our fellow human beings. It is just simply man who is not of God, who is not spiritually oriented, who has been born again of the Spirit. The man of the earth, who is now oppressing, who now seems to be ruling with such a high hand, there will come a time when he may no more oppress. Or the word oppress means to terrify. He'll no more be in a position to terrify his fellow man. God's going to step in. God's going to intervene. God's going to change the balance of power. And so that's a very comforting thought to those who are being oppressed, to those who seem to not be able to have any kind of control over their own destiny because this man of the earth is continually bringing about oppression or terrifying or somehow or other depriving his fellows of his rights, then God's going to see that that's going to be changed. Of course, we do not want to be classified ourselves as the man of the earth. We want to be a spiritual person, a person who is motivated and guided by the things of God rather than by the fleshly, earthly, temporal, sensual things here that the man of the earth would use as his motivation. So that brings to a close this 10th Psalm. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.